Our next speaker is Dr. Alexa Stiefbergen, and she is a professor at the University of Texas, Austin, and again has a phenomenal record of funding, I believe 13 years of continuous funding on an R01. And she will speak to us on the neuromotor deficits, chronically ill women, functional status, and quality of life.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here this afternoon to share with you a little bit, just a little slice of findings from a long-term program of research looking at health promotion and quality of life among persons with chronic and disabling conditions. We have been very blessed to be supported by NINR through a number of years and now have received continuation funding that we're also going to be able to continue with. The work. Also want to thank some magnificent collaborators, I think was the word used today, and that's certainly true of these folks. Tracy Harrison is here today, and the others have been key to the development of this work over time. Also wanted to note the origins of this work, which were from an F31, an individual pre-doc award, back in 1986. In fact, I think it was probably funded in the very first cycle of awards that came out of the National Center for Nursing Research. And then the work that I'll be presenting today started in 1993, the year we became an institute. So I really like these historic years for NINR. This has been a multi-phase series of group of studies that have evolved over time, and I just wanted to briefly sort of go through those to set the context for what I'll be presenting today. The first phase, which started in 1993, was a study where we used qualitative methods to refine and validate a model of health promotion and quality of life for persons with chronic and disabling conditions. Now, we did this study with persons with MS, but we were really viewing them as exemplars for persons living with chronic conditions. In the second phase, that model was refined and tested with a large sample of persons with MS. In the third phase, the model was cross-validated in a sample of persons with another chronic neurological condition. That was a nationwide sample of persons with post-polio syndrome. And even though there's a very different biological base for what's going on in those two conditions, they have very similar issues and problems that they live with in their everyday life. So actually, the model worked even better than I thought it would. In the fourth phase, which has been ongoing and is what I'll be reporting to you a little bit about today, we did a longitudinal follow-up of the people that were in that cross-sectional study in phase two, looking at a number of things, but among those, the trajectory of the illness-related limitations and quality of life outcomes. For those of you who aren't familiar with multiple sclerosis or MS, it's a disease that affects more than 350,000 persons in the U.S. and 2 million worldwide. If I could pick two words to describe it, only two, it would be unpredictable and variable. This is a very difficult disease to live with because people know so little about what's going to happen to them. When we all learned about it in school, we probably learned that it was a demyelinating disease. But what we know now more recently is that there's also damage and death of axons. So that accounts for some of the permanent damage that we see. Very wide disparity in symptoms. And the other thing that we know fairly recently in the last 10 years, or 15 years, would be that when the disease is clinically silent, when people look just fine, in fact, it tends to be neurologically active in most persons with MS most of the time, which is not what we used to believe. There have been a number of very important research successes that have gone on in MS research in the last 15 years. We've made a lot of progress in defining the pathological changes of MS. A lot of this has followed the development of MRI techniques and the enhancements with those to look at disease progress, and very importantly, development of the disease-modifying medications. Coincidentally, these were launched in about the same time, 1996-95, when we started our first cross-sectional survey. So we've been able to track drug use along this time as well for folks. But there are a number of unanswered questions in the literature or in the area at this time. We still know very little, really, about the natural history of functional limitations that accompany MS, which is often the question that individuals have. What's going to happen to me? What will happen next? There have been some fairly sophisticated and large longitudinal studies done in Europe where they would take all the biological variables, neurological variables that you might imagine, and with those we were able to basically explain and predict from the time that people would be diagnosed with the disease to the point where they required some assistance with ambulation. Maybe they needed a cane for a little bit of the time, maybe they needed to hold on to a staircase railing. But once you got to that point of needing a little bit of assistance with walking, we have not been able to explain any progression of functional limitations past that with the standard kinds of neurological variables, exacerbations, disease progression. So one of the questions that we've been interested in asking is what other behaviors, what things might be moderating the course of the disease-related limitations over time. And specifically, of course, we were interested in things that people could do something about behaviorally and specifically health promoting behaviors. So what I'll be talking about today is just a little slice of this study, a very small piece, where I'm going to describe the trajectories of functional limitations, health behaviors, specifically exercise, and perceived quality of life that we've observed over a 5-year time period in this sample of persons with MS. And then we'll be looking at the relationships between the characteristics of change in those outcomes and how they're moderated by a series of other variables. As I mentioned, it's been a longitudinal descriptive design, and it was a sample that was recruited out of that cross-sectional study that took place in 1996 and 97. What we did was mailed study information and questionnaires to 749 persons who had agreed to subsequent contacts and that we still had current addresses for. And once enrolled in the study, once they returned a questionnaire, agreed to be in the longitudinal study, we have mailed to them every year regardless, unless they asked to be dropped from the study. So let's say someone didn't return their questionnaire at year 3, we would still mail to them again in year 4 unless they had asked to be dropped from the study or had some other reason that they were out. We've had some very dramatic response rates over time. The very first year when we enrolled them in the longitudinal study, 83% of them. Since that time, it's been 85 to 90% of the eligible participants have responded. We've had about 60 official dropouts, and you can see we've had a few who've requested to be dropped. The biggest reason is really people have become too ill or they have died. So attrition has a factor that we'll bring up later in the results. I want to point out we've only lost 3 to follow up, being unable to follow up for their addresses. And Claire Ann Weiner taught me everything I know about keeping track of a longitudinal study, and I'm sorry she's not here today to hear that, but she really taught me some things early that have worked well. So our sample description, as you might have noticed, we started with 621, but it's down to 611 because 10 of those folks subsequently learned that they didn't have MS, and that is not surprising as the diagnosis is very difficult, but it's become a little bit clearer in these days. So at the start of the longitudinal study, these folks had an average age of 49 years. The majority were female, Anglo, pretty well educated, most were married. What's important to notice is only 25% of them are employed full-time, despite the fact that they have a mean age of 49. They've been diagnosed for an average of 13.5 years, and at this point in MS, even if you had straight relapsing remitting, you're beginning to experience some progression of functional limitations, so it's not surprising for us to see that. They've completed an extensive questionnaire battery annually, and I won't tell you how long it is because I'm embarrassed to admit it, but they have returned it. And we're just going to talk about 3 of these instruments today: the incapacity status scale, which is a measure of functional limitations, the exercise subscale we've used from the HPLP2, and the quality of life index. What I think is most important to sort of the take-home message for me today is about the data analysis methods that we've used. We've used multivariate latent curve modeling, which has had tremendous advantages in terms of a longitudinal study. For one thing, you can take into account missing data, so you don't lose a person who has skipped an interval, so that's wonderful. But one of the real strengths of this method is that you're able to look at change in an outcome at both the population level or the group level as well as the individual level. So you can look at individual differences in rates of change over time. And also now we're able to look at multiple outcome variables simultaneously. So there's a lot of strengths in the methods here. And I'll be talking about both the intercept, the time one value of these measures, and the slope, which is the rate of change over time. So first of all, the trajectory of these individual outcome variables. Well, one of the other strengths of this method is that you don't have to have a linear trajectory like you do in so many of our statistical techniques that we need to use. We have to either transform them if they're not linear. In this one, you can have quadratic effects, but they were best described by this linear trajectory. And we can have random effects on both the coefficients to have individual differences in change characteristics. So very important, we could look at the group level and the individual level. What we found looking at these three things, exercise behaviors, quality of life, and functional limitation, that the only one that changed significantly over this five-year period was functional limitation scores at the group level. Okay, so on average, exercise and quality of life didn't show any significant change over time, so we think nothing's happening. But in fact, that's not true. If we look at the individual level intercepts and the time effects, we see that about half of them are going up and half of them are going down. So of course, when you average them, you get zero. So that would have been missed in traditional kinds of analytic techniques. The red flag for that is that there are statistically significant differences in the variance, in the annual rates of change. So things are not happening the same here over time. This should not surprise anybody who knows anything about MS. It is not the same for any one person, and it's not the same any year to year. People may have a year where things just truly go to hell for them, and they have a lot of accumulation of limitations, and then things stabilize, and they're okay for three or four more years. So there's a lot of intra-individual and inter-individual differences here. We looked at a series of kind of those standard variables in terms of moderators of change over time. Very interesting that the level of functional limitations at time one, at the beginning of the longitudinal study, was moderated by these variables, but not the rate of change. So again, this is basically consistent with these large European studies where they have found that over time, once you reach this certain level of limitations, that we're not able to explain a great deal by things like age and time since diagnosis. Again, I would note here that attrition from the study is taken into effect here. So again, as you might expect, those people who are the most ill, or those who have died, or those who are institutionalized, are no longer in the study, and we can tell the effects of that in this case. These are the correlations among the variables at time one. No surprises here. This is very consistent with earlier work that we've had, that basically functional limitations negatively associated with exercise and quality of life. This is just the basic time one thing. What is more interesting is the correlation among the rates of change. So these are the slopes over time. If you'll see, the rate of change in exercise behaviors is negatively related to the change in functional limitations. So over time, people who have increasing rates of exercise behaviors have lower rates of functional limitations. And of course, the same thing is true for quality of life. Exercise and quality of life continue to be positively related. One of the things that I did not show in the slide is the second point here, which is the changes in functional limitations, so the slope of that and the intercept or the level of exercise behaviors at time one were negatively related. So people who had higher exercise levels at time one, again, had decreasing functional limitations, a rate of those over time. Now, this is a disease that doesn't just happen to people for 5 years. It happens to people for 30, 40, 50 years. They're often diagnosed in their 20s, 30s, and 40s. So they're living with this a long period of time. So I think anything that we can do to slow that accumulation of functional limitations is important. So my conclusions for this, well, first of all, I think that longitudinal studies that use analyses that allow us to examine both this individual group level of change, individual and group level, are very appropriate when examining trajectories. And this is particularly true in diseases like MS that have very individualized progression and presentation of the disease. Attrition is a significant limitation in any longitudinal study. We have not had a lot, but what we've had has been important, and you would expect would influence these results over time. So again, it should not be ignored. You have to take this into account, and we've been able to see, and we'll continue to watch. I expect it will become more of an effect over time for us. The other piece is that, of course, consistent with many earlier research studies, the change in functional limitations was slow. That's good news for folks who have MS. But it was significant and in a direction that is of increasing limitations. And this is a disease, again, that people are going to live with many years. So the impact of that over their lifetime is substantial. What we saw is that ongoing participation in exercise was related to the trajectory of functional limitations over time. Now, interestingly, as I mentioned, that increasing exercise scores at time one correlated with a decreased rate of change in functional limitations, the reverse was not true. So whatever your functional limitation was at time one, your intercept value, was not related to the rate of change or the slope in exercise behaviors. This is subtle but important, in that I have some colleagues that I try to correct every once in a while. They appreciate it too. When they tell me that exercise, you know, we're not going to include those people because they're mobility impaired, so we can't include them in our studies of exercise or even health promotion. And I get a little puffed up and explain to them why that's not a good idea. But here what we're seeing is that, in fact, the functional limitation levels at the beginning did not were not significantly related to this rate of exercise behavior, so there were many possibilities for folks. These findings are consistent with all the recent research that is documenting some positive short-term effects of exercise. So we've seen in our studies, we haven't been able to really see in intervention studies that short-term exercise interventions make a difference in terms of functional limitations because the rate of accumulation is too slow. But we can see some things that point that direction, and we can also see that it makes a difference short-term in terms of some aspects of quality of life. So putting all these findings together sort of really provides support, I think, for increasing our efforts at interventions to enhance physical activity in persons with MS. That said, these are very complex issues for a highly diverse group of persons with MS, and we need more sensitive measures. We need more information about specific adaptive techniques that might be most useful for people in a variety of settings. Our ongoing research that was just refunded by NINR, thank you, and I got the dates wrong. It's 2005 to 2010, and I'm not giving back that year. So we'll be able to continue the longitudinal follow-up, but we're doing a couple of other things that I think will be important. One is we're looking at the moderators of progression of functional limitations to disability. It may be inevitable and likely is that people will accumulate some level of functional limitations, but that is not the same as disability, which is the inability to fulfill your social roles, whether you're becoming unemployed, whether you're no longer able to take care of your children or work or fill whatever roles in your life. So we're looking at that piece of functional limitation to disability. Also looking at the impact of aging with disability, because this is becoming more and more of a priority issue in this country. And this sample is now, must be about in their mid-50s, and so we'll continue to follow them along. Also looking at the utility of self-report versus performance-based measures of functional limitations in terms of capturing the clinical expression of MS over time. So my final thoughts, this would just be that we have done, I think, a great job in nursing in terms of often really focusing on many of the things that occur in the context of a disease process. And one of the things we've tried to do in conjunction with the people that we've worked with is focus on their strengths and the positive resources that people use in their everyday lives. This is not the fanciest thing in the world, but it's the things people use in their everyday lives to just maintain and enhance their quality of life.